Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Diane Taylor. Each week at this time, we visit with an author or perhaps a playwright, a singer-songwriter, or a publisher, anyone who's involved with the arts in our region. We hope to find out a little bit more about his or her life, what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. We're very pleased to have Diane Taylor with us today and hope to hear about the workshop that she's agreed to give at the Spirit of the Hills Festival of the Arts on November 3rd and 4th at St. Peter's Anglican Church. Welcome, Diane.
Thanks. Nice to see you, Gwen.
Yeah. Actually, I suppose I should be saying welcome back because we've had you on the program several times with various things you've written.
A few times, that's true.
Diane Taylor has had several careers as a medical lab tech, a teacher, a sailor, and a writer. She is the author of The Gift of Memoir and is well known as a workshop presenter and teacher of memoir writing. She has also written many articles for newspapers and magazines. She started writing while sailing in the Caribbean because life on the ocean and in the islands was so fresh and immediate. She felt an urgent need to record it so as not to forget it, to re-experience it in words, and to communicate it to others in various sailing magazines. A book resulted from this, The Perfect Galley Book. And she discovered that writing was another way of educating and became passionate about creating narratives and records. So, Diane, why is memoir writing so important to you?
Well, it goes back to the 60s when a book came out. Well, it was a series of books actually called the Foxfire Books, but it was a high school teacher in Georgia in the States who was about to lose his English classes in grade 9 and 10 and because they weren't paying attention, and he figured he had to grab their attention, so he decided to teach them interviewing skills to enable them to go out into the hills and get the stories of people who had lived there for 60, 70, 80 years. And they interviewed these people, and what they were doing really was recording a way of life that would have disappeared had they not recorded it. And it just struck me as a really valuable thing to do, to capture things from the past that would disappear if they weren't written down in a visible and accessible way. And I promised myself that when life slowed down, I would pass along ways for people to record their own histories.
So what is the difference between an autobiography and a memoir?
Well, basically, an autobiography is usually a whole life, and it's quite factual and doesn't delve into emotions so much, whereas memoir is usually a period of a life, a slice of your life, maybe a two-year period or a five-year period. Out of Africa was a five-year period, and or it could be the childhood years, like Angela's Ashes was the first 19 years of Frank McCourt's life.
Memoir seems to be more and more accessible these days, but do you find that younger people are interested in memoir because they're at the beginning of their lives, and how do they view memoir?
Yes, people of all ages have come to my workshops, and probably the youngest was late 20s, and she wanted to learn about memoir writing because she was going into social work, and she wanted to be able to pass on to her clients how to write the stories of their life, because it can be therapy. Barack Obama was 34 when he wrote his first memoir. That's quite young.
That is really quite young. You know, there's almost not enough life to write about.
Yeah, it's a great memoir. And then a couple of years ago, Malala came out with her memoir.
Right,
she was 16 at the time.
Yes, because she had such an extraordinary early life, didn't she?
Really, And she did have help with it, but basically it's her story.
Yeah, interesting. When you're writing a memoir, you said it differs from an autobiography in as much as it's not just fact. It goes into emotions and things like that. So is it important then to have a narrative, a story going?
Well, there are two different ways to do it. And one is to write various crucial episodes of your life without a storyline. But they do reflect your life. And the other way is to have a real storyline with real characters of whom you are the main one, and with events that leap off the page, and with all the techniques that a novel would use.
Mm. Yeah, so dialogue and things like that.
Right, yes, dialogue and lots of specific detail, and drama, of course.
Yeah. And conflict and all those things.
Right.
So why do you think memoir has become so popular?
Yeah. I think partly because we have an aging population on our hands, and people are living longer, and they have the time to think about what is valuable to leave behind them, and they're turning to memoir to do that.
So it's not just history, it's advice, and it's all sorts of legacies, isn't it?
It really is. It's leaving a heritage gift for your children and grandchildren and even generations as yet unborn. Mm-hmm. I know some people in my classes have had memoirs published, and I'm sure that there will be copies around in 200 or even 300 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a sobering thought, isn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'd love you to read something for us. Could you tell us what you've chosen to read?
Well, it was really hard to pick something to read, and I spent a couple of hours yesterday going over favorite memoirs, and I've selected a piece from a man who took my course a year or so ago, and he spent, when he was quite young, his first job, 2 years in Romania while it was still behind the Iron Curtain, and he writes really well, and the University of Bucharest was really pleased to see an account of those years, because those years have been mostly forgotten.
Mm.
So he brings them to life. And this particular section comes from before he arrives in Romania. He has to go through medical. So he calls it the terms of appointment. His name is Ronald McKay. The terms of my appointment demanded I undergo a thorough medical examination conducted by a government doctor in Aberdeen. When, once back in Aberdeen, I called the doctor to ask for an appointment, he made an issue of the fact that because the request was from government, he could see me only outside normal surgery hours. So long as it was soon, the timing of the appointment itself was irrelevant to me. I accepted the date he insisted on and duly arrived at the appointed time. His surgery door, with his consulting hours engraved on a shiny brass plate, stood adjacent to his home. It was firmly locked, so I used the shiny brass knocker 3 times without an answer. With trepidation, I knocked at the front door of his house. A long pause, then an elderly gentleman appeared. What did I want? Couldn't I see that his surgery hours were over? He pointed to the brass plate. I explained who I was, that he had given me an appointment, 7 p.m. He was either in a bad temper or desperately needed his evening meal. He looked at his watch. You're 5 minutes late. I explained I'd knocked at his surgery door at exactly 7 o'clock. Can ye no read? Surgery's closed. But wait. He disappeared behind his front door, and I heard him lock it. I stood there, bewildered. A minute later, I hear the key turn in the surgery door. He stood scowling at me. Well, dinna just stand there gawping. Do you think I can examine ye on the doorstep? Once inside, he ordered me to strip to the waist, then probed and listened front and back with ice-cold fingers and Arctic stethoscope. He looked at my extended tongue behind my ears, tapped my knees viciously with a rubber hammer shaped like an Indian tomahawk, then pointed wordlessly to his scales. 10 stone exactly. He scratched his numbers into the form with a fountain pen. He ran a wooden level down his rule to the top of my head. 7. More scratching. 7? I queried. 5'7". He looked up at me from his desk, hostile. I'm 5'7½, I ventured. At 25, the half inch made all the difference in the world to me. The old Aberdonian gave me a cold look. Are ye saying my rule's no accurate enough for ye? A rhetorical question. an accusation. This was not going well. I decided on the spot that the half inch was irrelevant after all and kept my mouth firmly shut. He scratched 5'7" on the form and pressed the wet ink with blotting paper, recording my deficient height forever and ever. Finally, he placed my arm on his desk, wrapped a heavy cuff around my upper arm, pumped air into the contraption using a rubber bulb, and finally, when I thought he was going to cut off my blood circulation, released the pressure. He read the glass dial. I followed his hand with my eyes as he scratched numbers into the form. Hostile, he shielded the entry he'd made with his left hand. "This information is for the government. Confidential," he said. I was able to read the final question on the form. "In your professional opinion, does the candidate show the mental stability necessary to serve in a responsible British government post overseas?" To avoid running any risk of his scratching in a categorical no, I obediently averted my eyes and smiled benignly, doing my best to appear compos mentis. He shot me a few curt questions about my parents, siblings, and experience at Aberdeen University and scratched something about my mental state into the final box. I kept my eyes averted. Then he silently read the final line on the form, "Country of appointment, Romania." He read the line several times, then he looked up at me with respect for the first time. "Romania?" I nodded. "Bucharest." "Romania? That's behind the Iron Curtain," I nodded, expressionless. "And what might you be going to be doing there?" He was impressed and curious. I met his eyes, held his gaze. When the silence of the moment had reached its peak, I lowered my voice. "Government information, doctor. Confidential. I'm sorry." He looked as if he'd been caught with his hand in the biscuit tin. "Oh, of course, I wasn't thinking. I understand. Forget the question, will ye? Confidential, of course." He hurriedly scratched his signature on the bottom, folded the form and placed it in the stamped, self-addressed envelope to disguise his embarrassment. He assured me he would post it that very night. He stood up and offered me his hand. "Good luck. Mind new and come back safe." In his eyes, I was no longer a mere 5'7". I was now key player in the intrigues of the Cold War. I left his office feeling more like the 6'2" Edinburgh Coleman Sean Connery.
That was delightful. You made a good pick.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Diane Taylor, who will be facilitating a workshop on memoir writing at the upcoming Arts Festival on November 3rd and 4th. And now we'll take a short break.